I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Of all the names that fill American literary roles, none sparks such an immediate image of hipness, spontaneity, and the unfurling road like Jack Kerouac. With last year's film Howl, about beat writer, poet, and contemporary of Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, there's been a surge of popular interest again in the beat writers, writers like Kerouac. Many people know that he died in Florida in 1969 in St. Petersburg. Fewer know that the poet and writer lived in Orlando, though, for a few years, in the late 1950s with his mother in the College Park neighborhood. That's where Kerouac received the first reviews of his classic novel, On the Road, and where his next work, The Dharma Bums, was banged out on a typewriter. That's where we are right now. We've taken Intersection on the road to the house at 1418 Clouser Ave. I'm joined by Bob Keeling. You may know him as a reporter for NBC TV affiliate WESH, but he also helped resurrect the lost history of Kerouac in Orlando. He wrote the 2002 book Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends, and co-founded the Jack Kerouac Writers in Residence Project of Orlando, which renovated the home. Bob Keeling, great to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined in the Kerouac House by one of the great contemporary voices of American literature, former Poet Laureate of the United States, Billy Collins. He teaches writing at Rollins College and is also a great admirer of Kerouac and beat literature. Billy, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Well, let's start from square one, which I know starting in a square might not be very hip, but Bob Keeling, who were the Beats?
Touche. Well, the Beats were a group of, I want to say New York writers, for instance. There was Kerouac, there was Ginsberg, there was William Burroughs, among others. And I think what makes the Beats so interesting and so enduring is their more confessional style of writing. They looked outside the box of traditional and contemporary literature at the time. You know, you had Hemingway with The Lost Generation, and here comes Kerouac and his confederates with the Beat Generation. And Kerouac said that there was a misunderstanding with the term beat. It didn't mean beat up or beaten down or downtrodden. To him, it meant beatific, that they were on a spiritual journey. And that, in a sense, is what he thought Beat and the Beats meant. But I remember seeing a quote from, I want to say, William Burroughs, who said he felt that America was a much freer and open society because of beat literature. And I think that's it in a nutshell.
Is that a label, the Beats, that they would have used for themselves?
I think, I can only presume, but I would say in Kerouac's mind, he hated being called a beatnik, because he thought he was being sort of pigeonholed and put into that whole Dobie Gillis and, you know, wear a beret and sunglasses indoors and, you know, grab your bongo drums. It was a cliche. That's not what he meant. He meant beatific and on this spiritual journey. So he might call himself a beat if you refer to him in that sense.
Well, Billy Collins, why is the literature of the Beat Generation significant?
Well, it's. I think you can put it in some kind of historical context, even though it was very new at the time, and as you said, outside the box that we knew as contemporary fiction back then, and poetry. It was a movement toward spontaneity, basically, and away from premeditation. So it was like a little bit like the English Romantic poets who claimed, I mean, Coleridge claimed to have written Kubla Khan in a kind of, laudanum trance, and Wordsworth claimed that he made his poems up while he was walking around. There was probably a lot more premeditation that went into it. But it was a matter of kind of drug-fueled sitting down and just writing. Truman Capote was famous for criticizing Kerouac by calling On the Road typing, not writing. But the idea was just to remove the kind of literary self-consciousness and literary barriers that would that was a very anti-Henry James kind of movement. So you would sit down with a typewriter and go. You would just type all night and see what came out. And revision was thought of as using the bad side of the brain.
And you know, it's interesting, Mark, picking up on what Billy said, there's an interesting quote from Kerouac that says, what America wants to hide, revise, and unsay is exactly what our society is waiting and bleeding for.
Yeah, and I mean, it also is connected to psychoanalysis, you know, that the sense of you talk to the therapist in this very unfettered, free associative way. And in doing that, you have the potential to surprise yourself by releasing this inner stuff. And that's basically, that accounts for the spontaneity accounts for the spirit, I think, of beat literature. It also accounts for the sloppiness of it. If On the Road is a fascinating book. There was nothing like it at the time. I was 16 when that came out, so I was the perfect audience. You know, my mother used to say I was the original teenager. And so I'd never seen the word chick in print. You know, I'd never seen all this language that was kind of in the air, but now it was written down, and it was a very wild thing to get your hands on and to read. At the same time, looking back on it, I mean, I reread it maybe 8 or 9 years ago to teach a course, and there's really no narrative arc. I mean, it's a kind of narrative vacancy. It just kind of goes on. Dharma Bums is like that too. It follows the experience of his travels, and his travels were essentially chaotic, and therefore the fiction it tends to be moving in no set direction.
Well, let's talk about that, the travels of Kerouac, Bob Keeling, because we think of Jack Kerouac being this free spirit from the Northeast. He's zooming back and forth across the U.S., heading south to Mexico. We don't really think of him in Florida, so why was he in Orlando?
I dare say, when he was living here, he was a mama's boy. Imagine the dichotomy. Imagine the dichotomy of being the free spirit, of influencing the 16-year-old Billy Collins types out there in America and thinking, wow, he's my hero, and he's showing me the road. And at the same time, by the time he moves down here in 57, he's living with his mom in the suburbs because Kerouac's sister moved down here with her husband and their child. And anywhere the only nuclear family in the Kerouac life went, Jack and his mom would follow. So it is interesting to think here he is, the avatar of the beat generation, and yet he's living with his mom in the suburbs of Orlando.
And these weren't particularly happy times for Kerouac, were they?
It's interesting. I think it's fair to say that Kerouac had a real love-hate relationship with Florida. He would be in New York City, or he'd be somewhere very congested, and he'd be with all of his running mates and start drinking too much, partying too much. So they'd come down here, and at least at the beginning, he would have this sense of being back and in the fresh air and in the sunshine. But after a while, that would fade away, and the boredom would set in, and then the drinking, and so that did make his experience a lot more difficult down here.
Billy, what's your impression of when On the Road came out, of the waves that it made in literary circles? Was it immediately a big hit?
I think it was. It got one very good review in the New York Times Book Review. I forget who wrote it, but it was that review kind of put him on the map and gave him this respectability, whether he wanted that or not. there's a sense in which he really did. There's such an odd cast of characters that make up the Beat Generation. I mean, you have Ginsberg, who is kind of New York Jewish. You have Kerouac, who is from a Milltown in Massachusetts, Catholic. And French Canadian. You have this odd mix, and then William Burroughs and Ferlinghetti and Corso and others, all from all different places. And you know, Ginsberg became a kind of global celebrity after in the 60s and 70s. And as you say, Kerouac kind of went back to his mother and did a lot of drinking. So it was productive in that he wrote Dharma Bums, but subsequent to that, it was quite, I think, self-destructive.
And I think his life's very much a cautionary tale. I don't think he ever found a real comfortable transition into middle age, and I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah, don't go back and live with your mother would be one piece of advice.
Well, it tends to discourage the girlfriends.
To get a sense of that, Bob Keeling, I know you've got some letters that Kerouac actually wrote about his experience here in Orlando. So while you pull that up, I'll take this moment just to say that You are listening to Intersection. We are on the road at the Kerouac House in Orlando. I'm joined by Bob Keeling, who wrote the book Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends. We're also joined by former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins. You're listening to 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. I'm Mark Simpson. So, Bob Keeling, you have come across some of these letters that Kerouac wrote to some of his beat writer colleagues that set kind of the tone for what it was like for him here in Orlando. What do you got?
Well, here's one from July of 1957, July 22nd, and it's interesting. The address is actually listed as 1418 and a half Clouser, which is the back porch apartment, that tiny little cave of a place where he moved in. And he's writing his girlfriend at the time, Joyce Glassman, who now is the very noted writer Joyce Johnson. And he talks about this lack of respect from his family. And he tells her he's basically broke now. He said, "I moved my mother back to Orlando, leaving me with $33, which I think is a big joke in the family, since she wound up around the corner from where we started, and everybody comes around every night to laugh. And the review copy of On the Road, well, it's unread on the shelf. And now, beyond this bugging stage, I'm becoming enraged. So I'm going to go to Mexico tomorrow on the chance that Viking, his publisher, will feed me down there."
Kerouac ready to get out of town.
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, it didn't go too well for him down there. He goes to Mexico, and he's involved in an earthquake, and then he gets robbed. And then by August, he wants to come back here, and he's got a case of what he calls the Asiatic flu. And so he comes back, and he gets poured out of a cab here and comes around to the back porch, and after his big trip to Mexico and his mom's not home, so he curls up in the yard and falls asleep, sick with fever. It's August of 57.
Talk to me a little bit more about that lifestyle that Kerouac had here while he was in Orlando, because he was isolated, right? His friends, Neil Cassidy, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, no one really came to see him down
here. No, they didn't. None of them came to visit. And you'd see all these urging letters to people like Ferlinghetti saying, "Oh, this is such a clean place with these great highways and spotless roads, and I'll cook you a big thick steak." But no one came. And in Ginsberg's case, Kerouac's mother didn't like him, and she had a string of anti-Semitism in her, and she thought that he was a bad influence. And Joyce, the girlfriend he wrote to, said that she felt that his mother was a rival. So she was a very domineering influence in his life, especially here.
I think when you think of those, the differences we were talking about, of the, you know, ethnic and geographical differences between, you know, Ferlinghetti and Kerouac and Ginsberg, et cetera, those differences tend to get more italicized as they got older. And, you know, what brought them together, this kind of magic moment where they had this literary revolution, I think they went their separate ways, and that's why the odd thing about the real difference that or the drama of Kerouac's life seems to be this amazing sense of expansiveness. I mean, he's out there under the stars. I mean, the title Dharma Bums, he really, bum for him was a good word. I mean,
absolutely,
bum meant, it's not a good word today, but people are afraid to use it. We use homeless as a euphemism.
Transient,
for that.
Yeah.
But bum meant someone who was liberated, someone who had no commitments, and he learned in Dharma Bums, he learns from Gary Snyder how to reduce your world to a backpack. And so you have your cooking goods and you have some dried fruit, and you're on the road, and you're hopping, you know, boxcars and freight trains and the rest of it. And there's this tremendous sense of expansiveness. There's a little passage here from On the Road, where he just is writing. He says, "The stars," he's outside, he says, "The stars bent over the little roof, smoke poked up from the stove top chimney. I smelled mashed beans and chili. The old man growled, a California home. I hid in the grapevines, digging it all. I felt like $1 million. I was adventuring in the crazy American night." So to be out there, footloose, fancy free, and then to have that whole exploratory sense of the American space, you know, the great democratic space and On the Road, to be reduced now, as we're sitting in this tiny house in Orlando, to see that kind of shrinking world, that it kind of returned to the mother, and the sort of claustrophobic experience where you're thrown back on yourself and your alcohol in this case.
Well, we've talked so much about this house. I wonder if I can get both of you to maybe contribute. Just describe the setting that we're in right now. And I don't know, Bob, can you tell us, is this similar at all to the original setting and coloration of the house? What can you tell us?
Well, I think architecturally, yes, it is similar.
A Florida bungalow.
It is. It's a shotgun shack, really. And it dates back to 1929. And it was built by a noted architect here in Central Florida by the name of Clauser, and he built it, as I said, in 1929. The thing people don't realize is that it was not a single-family dwelling. That the place where Kerouac rented was actually this very small cave-like apartment that had been added to the back porch. And we think it was added around the time of World War II to be housing for bachelor soldiers. So as Billy was mentioning, you have this wide open life and all these fantastic travels, and then you're put into this compressed little space. You could see why it would be such a difficult adjustment.
I do want to get up and do a quick walk through the house with both Billy and Bob. So let's get ready and we'll go do that.
It will be quick.
We're in kind of the immediate room. You've just come in through the front door. What do you see?
Well, this it's filled with books appropriately, and it has a kind of a really nice, updated, but yet kind of a hip 1950s look that you might imagine from that time period. And it's been home to dozens of aspiring writers since this program started in 1999. And it's a pleasure to have you here.
And Billy Collins, this is your first visit to the Kerouac House. What are your impressions?
Well, it's small. It's a rather modest looking house. I mean, if you compare it to, I don't know, Robertson Jeffers' house in Carmel overlooking the Pacific, or even Hemingway's house in Key West, rather elaborate, with one of the first swimming pools in North America. It's a very modest, unprepossessing house, and but it says so much, I think, the size of it, the modest size of it, and the location of it says so much about Kerouac, who, you know, was on the road reaching for what he called the pearl, you know, always on the search. If you can go faster and faster, you'll find something out there. And to land here, it's a very kind of paradoxical, I wouldn't say the ending of his life, but the latter part of his life, to be enclosed in this modest house in Orlando.
Bob Keeling, lead us through and describe at where we're going as you can take us.
Right, we're actually going to go to the back porch part of this house. Believe it or not, even though this place is small, the front of the house would be like living in the Taj Mahal compared to where we're going in the back. And this doorway that we're entering was the actual dividing line between the two dwellings.
So it was originally a split dwelling. It's now been combined into one.
And when I first came back here 15 years ago, there were a pair of antique dealers living here. And I think they were having a tough time staying in retirement because they had bric-a-brac all over the place. I didn't even know this bedroom over here existed. So as I come in this tiny little door here, which is, what, maybe 6 feet tall, it's open, and there are squirrels running in and out.
And Billy Collins is taller than the door.
Well, you'd have to duck to walk in this back door, yeah. Even if you were a squirrel, you might have to duck.
So the squirrels are running around in here, and what do you find?
So the squirrels are coming, running around, and this nice lady who's sitting on this divan-type convertible sofa bed invites me to sit down. So I kind of take a seat here, and as I'm talking to her about Kerouac and having lived here, I notice something crawling on my shoulder, and it's a roach, so I kind of brush it off my shoulder as I'm talking to her. I mean, this is the kind of the existence that these people were living in. This place was covered with this austere brown paneling that made it look more like a cave than an actual apartment.
And now it's kind of nice pastel colors.
It is. I mean, it's gotten at least a nice little facelift, but I dare say it's still rather beat back here. But on a more serious note, it is compelling. It is moving to think that while Kerouac finally receives the notoriety, the respect as a writer that he's been dying to have, he's still living in this meager, really poverty-ridden, hand-to-mouth existence, but he keeps working at it, you know. But he finally saw some success. He's finally on the New York Times bestseller list while he's living here.
Now, what room did he actually write in while he was here?
Well, he wrote in this 10 by 10 bedroom back here. So if you like, let's head on back.
So this is a really small room. I mean, this is about the size of maybe a college dorm room single, if you're lucky.
I think this is the room where, even though I've just been here, this is my first visit, this is the room where I got the kind of feeling for Kerouac. On the wall, there's kind of three photographs of him sitting there typing with a flannel shirt, and apparently that was done in this room. And it is a tiny room, and it's really quite exciting to think that Dharma Bums, which is basically about hiking in the Sierra Mountains in California and being running around with Gary Snyder, all took place in this, I would say, rather claustrophobic environment.
A freedom of the mind not confined by your physical surroundings.
Absolutely, and somebody was mentioning last night that at Robertson Jeffers' house that overlooks the Pacific, his writing desk faced a wall. You know, he didn't want to look at the Pacific. It was, the view is of your imagination, and in Kerouac's case, memory. And memories can take place in a closet.
Well, now that we're back from our walking tour of the Kerouac House, it's a good time to remind our listeners you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM, Orlando, Melbourne, and Daytona Beach. We're talking with local Kerouac scholar Bob Keeling and former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins about Jack Kerouac and the Beats. What are your memories of beat writer Jack Kerouac? What novels did you like? Did you read On the Road in high school or Dharma Bums? Did it mean a lot to you? Share your thoughts at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. You can also send an email to intersection@wmfe.org. And we've been talking about that book, Dharma Bums, that Jack Kerouac actually wrote in this house where we are on location at. And Billy Collins, you've got a passage queued up from Dharma Bums.
Yeah, there's the Dharma Bums is about his travels largely with Gary Snyder. And in this passage, they just wake up. Yeah, there's a lot of the style of it is very much I did this, I did that. I mean, if they had beans or chili for lunch, he would put that in there. There's everything is just thrown in. But there are moments of insight, too. So he gets up before the others in the morning. I rousted about and got a lot of little pieces of wood to make kindling for the fire. And then I went around gathering bigger pieces. And finally, I was hunting out huge logs, easy to find all over the place. We had a fire that Morley must have seen from 5 miles away, except we were way up behind the cliff face, cut off from his view. It cast mighty blasts of heat against our cliff. The cliff absorbed it and threw it back, and we were in a hot room, except that at the ends of our noses were nippy from sticking them out of that area to get firewood and water. Jaffe put the bulgur in the pot with water and started it boiling and stirred it around, and meanwhile busied himself with the mixings for the chocolate pudding and started boiling that in a separate small pot out of my knapsack. He also brewed a fresh pot of tea. Then he whipped out his double set of chopsticks, and pretty soon we had our supper ready and laughed over it. It was the most delicious supper of all time. Up out of the orange glow of our fire, you could see immense systems of uncountable stars, either as individual blazers or in low Venus droppers or vast Milky Ways, incommensurate with human understanding, all cold, blue, silver. But our food and our fire was pink and goodies. And true to what Jaffe had predicted, I had absolutely not a jot appetite for alcohol. I'd forgotten all about it. The altitude was too high, the exercise too heavy, the air too brisk. The air itself was enough to get your drunk ass drunk. It was a tremendous supper. Food is always better eaten in doleful little pinchfuls off the ends of chopsticks. No gobbling. The reason why Darwin's law of survival applies best to China. If you don't know how to handle a chopstick and stick it in that family pot with the best of them, you'll starve. I ended up flubbing it all up with my forefinger anyhow.
You really get that appreciation for the simple, but I still hear the racing around of On the Road is not in that particular passage.
Well, you get this. You're going from chocolate pudding to the Milky Way. I mean, pretty much as everything is included. So I think that's the texture of a lot of his writing is you get very specific details of what shirt he put on and that. And then suddenly there's a kind of epiphanic insight into the cosmic reality of what is the holiness, you know, that sense of beatific, which he really gets from his Catholicism as a description of the Blessed Virgin Mary, I think, and beatific visions. But that sense of the holiness of the universe and that great expansive Buddhist sense of the holiness and preciousness of life. but always anchored to the details of getting kindling, getting on your knapsack, catching a freight train.
Why did Kerouac end up leaving Orlando?
Well, his mother would have a difficult time figuring out what to do with her son once the alcoholism started coming back in. And even though in this house, I think, was his last prolific period, still, it's the boredom. Remember, we don't have the internet. His books were banned here. So it was just, hey, it's we don't know what else to do. Let's have another move. I mean, they moved a whole lot.
And eventually ended up in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, they ended up in St. Petersburg because Kerouac had had a big fight with his brother-in-law. And it's kind of a sad story. The first time they were there was in 1964, and his sister Carolyn died here in Orlando. And he felt a terrible sense of guilt that he wasn't there to help her. And he was so distraught that he actually locked himself in the bathroom and wouldn't come to her funeral.
How does the story of Jack Kerouac in Orlando and Florida close out?
It never ends. Where the road ends, his legacy lives. And we have wonderful writers like Caitlin Doyle, who are here now. We've had dozens of people. And you know, I asked Kerouac's buddy, David Amram, who is one of our benefactors, thankfully. And I said, how would Kerouac react to this? And without pausing a beat, he said he would have cried. And I think the sense is that not only is he regarded as an important American writer, but his legacy is helping nurture the careers of other writers.
Billy Collins, I'd love to close out with a poem from you. I know you've got one that talks a little bit about
Kerouac. Coincidence, my father was born in Lowell, Massachusetts in 1901. I was always, when I became a kind of Catholic high school beatnik, when I read it on the road, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to steal a car, take a lot of pills, drive to Denver, get some bongos, meet some chicks. But I had a quiz the next day at this Catholic high school, so I couldn't just break away like that. But my father and Jack Kerouac, you could not imagine two more disparate people. You could describe my father as the anti-beatnik, and I was always struck with that, that these two men came out of that same environment. So I have a little poem called Lowell Mass. Kerouac was born in the same town as my father, but my father never had time to write on the road, let alone drive around the country in circles. He wrote notes for the kitchen table and a novel of checks and a few speeches to lullaby businessmen after a fat lunch. And some of his writings are within me, for I house catalogs of jokes and handbooks of advice on horses, snow tires, women, along with some short stories about the deadbeats at the office. But he was quicker to pick up a telephone than a pen. Like Jack, he took a drink, but beatific to him meant the Virgin Mary. He called jazz jungle music, and he would have told Neil Cassidy to let him off at the next light. Neil Cassidy being the driver in On the Road.
Great final thoughts there from Billy Collins. He's a former U.S. Poet Laureate and a fellow at the Winter Park Institute at Rollins College. Billy, thanks for coming over to the Kerouac House.
You're very welcome.
And also thanks to Bob Keeling, who is co-founder of the Jack Kerouac Writers in Residence program. He's also author of Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends, and an updated edition of that is coming out this spring. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Find out more about Jack Kerouac and tell us your thoughts online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you'll find links to the Florida Talks blog and our weekly podcast. Plus, we have lots of web extras for this episode. We'll have an interview with Kerouac writer-in-residence Caitlin Doyle. Special thanks to Mac Dula, our audio engineer, and to Carly Talbot, our intern, and to the folks at the Kerouac House for hosting us. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.